You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn more about the history of Memorial Day with historian Kenneth C. Davis. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about a self-employed dog trainer and how the pandemic has affected his way of life.
It's been a few months since people have had to make changes in their lives because of COVID-19. Some get to work from home, and some folks still have to go to a workplace using extra caution. And still others lost their jobs when the businesses they worked at closed. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, George Malara filled his work days with dogs.
I drive around in my old Honda Odyssey, and I pick up dogs all over Madison, and we end up on my property, and we run and play with the dogs in a fenced-in area.
Malara owns Divine Canine Dog Training and Want to Go Outside Playgroup Service. We talked at his private play area while his new pup Dolly, his other dog Suka, and my dog Sasha played in the yard.
Since the pandemic hit, I felt it more responsible to not go into my clients' homes because not only do I have clients that are doctors and pediatricians and doctors that work in the ER, but I also have clients that are a little bit older that could be more so compromised because of the virus. So I felt it responsible to sort of cut back on that and stop my playgroup service so that I could help flatten the curve and do my part.
Come here, Dolly.
After canceling my playgroup service due to the pandemic, that was essentially 85% of my income. You know, the playgroup is my bread and butter, and I would train dogs and do classes in the evenings Monday through Friday. The difficult part of this is, for me, the withdrawal from the dogs. These dogs are absolutely a part of my life, and I call them my babies, I call them my buddies, I call them, you know, I develop a bond and I work with them daily. And to go cold turkey like that has been incredibly difficult emotionally. It's what I've been doing for 20 years. I don't know what to do with myself. I have other work I'm doing. I'm shooting videos and adapting with my training business to offer more stuff virtually. But the playgroup is what I really miss the most.
Very good girls. Very good girls.
Originally, I went to college to become a CBT, a certified behavioral therapist, working with children. And my college funds ran out and I was unable to continue going to school. My roommate and I adopted a dog named CJ, and he had some behavioral issues. And I took what I learned in the little bit of college that I went to and applied it to my dog, and it worked. I'm what you call a crossover trainer. So when I first started training dogs, I used some aversive techniques. I would like pop a leash if the dog was doing something wrong, or I would verbally reprimand. But as I evolved as a trainer, my techniques got sweeter and more scientific. I started using carrots instead of the whip. I think what I really love is seeing how happy the dogs are socializing. My favorite thing to watch is just all the little behaviors that they do, the communication that they have. I often say, like, I'm Jane Goodall. Like, I just get to watch these behaviors during playgroup and all the subtleties that they are able to express in these little tiny minute movements in their bodies.
Now that many of us are spending more time at home, we have an opportunity to focus on our pets. So where's a good place for us to start?
Oh, lots of training. There's so many things you can do and teach your dogs. You know, you can go on YouTube and just type in positive reinforcement training, or another technique that I love is shaping. You know, shaping games with your dogs. Just play with your dog. People think training means obedience, and that's not really the case. Training your dog could be anything. It could be something silly like a trick, or something complex like a freestyle, which is a dance routine with your dog.
Besides trying to figure out ways to stay in touch with his clients and help them work with their dogs, Malara is working on finding his way in this time of seclusion.
I'm taking this isolation in stride, and I'm learning a lot about myself in terms of being alone and just being patient with myself and just being with my emotions as they come. Sometimes I feel great, and sometimes I feel down. You know, it's like, I love that saying, it's okay to not be okay, and it's okay to not be productive. When the stay-at-home effort is here, it's to keep everybody safe. Nobody's being punished here. Nobody's in trouble. But if we continue to go out, this is going to keep going unless we take care of it. And it's we, not me. We all have our part.
Oh, if you don't know how to do it, I would show you how to walk the dog.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, don't you hate it when this happens to you?
Clever girl.
That's the sound of a man being outwitted and attacked by two velociraptors in 1993's Jurassic Park. The movie portrayed those dinosaurs as clever predators that worked together to hunt their prey. Except, maybe they didn't, really. New research out of UW Oshkosh shows that they may have been more likely to have hunted solo. Joseph Fredrickson is a vertebrate paleontologist and director of the Wise Earth Science Museum at the Fox Cities campus of the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. He recently led a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology, showing that velociraptors likely did not hunt in packs. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about the scientific background on this issue, first of all, that led us to think and led the producers of Jurassic Park to think that velociraptors were pack hunters?
Absolutely. So the scientific background for Jurassic Park is based on a dinosaur called Deinonychus, which lived in North America around 110 million years ago. Velociraptor, the animal, is actually from the late Cretaceous and is only a little bit larger than a turkey. So they wanted to spice that up a little bit and give it a more scary animal as one of the main characters. So they changed it to this animal, Deinonychus. And Deinonychus, when it was first found, was found in these bone beds with multiple individuals alongside a much larger plant-eating dinosaur. And the scientists who discovered it thought there's no way that these dinosaurs could hunt these animals alone. And the fact that they were found together means that they were probably hunting in groups like we see in modern dogs, wolves, and lions.
And we can't go back and run the tape on how they really hunted. So what kind of information are you looking at that says, well, hold the phones, maybe they didn't hunt like that in these packs?
Absolutely. We cannot see the actual behavior of these animals. That just does not fossilize. All we have is a bunch of these animals that were found together. And there's many reasons why animals would be found, you know, that would all have died at the same time or in the same area. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were behaving as social animals do today. And the reason that we are starting to suspect that this may not be true for raptors is just we don't see this type of behavior in their living relatives, crocodilians or birds. They just don't hunt in packs in the same way that dogs do or cats, lions do. So what we decided to look at was something else, was something that is a situation where animals like wolves or lions, when they're growing up, they tend to eat the same things as the adults. If you're a pack hunter, you feed the babies what you're eating. Crocodiles and animals like Komodo dragons and other animals that are asocial don't do this. So if you were to look at the diet of an animal as it grows up, if it's the same as the adults, as the adult diet, you'd suspect that these things were not were social animals. But if it was different, it could be that they were more asocial.
So if I'm a baby in that asocial pack family, I might hunt different things. I might be in different places, different kind of terrain even than mom and dad, and I'm on my own to find the food. Am I hearing you right?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we see in crocodiles. Essentially, once the babies hatch, they're sort of on their own. The mom may hang around for a little while to protect them, but she's not feeding them. So they have to eat things like minnows and tadpoles and spiders, while the adults are eating mammals. They're eating deer. They're even eating other crocodiles or alligators. So you'll see a very different diet between the babies and the adults in these non-social pack-hunting animals or non-pack-hunting animals.
Interesting. So we've got this teeth evidence here we're working with. What other evidence would you like to see that, you know, we might reasonably hope to find at some point that would help settle things stronger in one direction or another now?
Well, we have to take a step back and just realize that this is just one set of evidence from one dinosaur. So what we found was that in Deinonychus, in sites in Oklahoma and in Montana, the babies had a different diet than adults. Their teeth had different chemistry. That chemistry comes from their diet. It looks like the babies were eating things like smaller lizards or mammals while the adults were eating these big herbivores. So first of all, we need to look at that across the spectrum of these types of dinosaurs. What does it actually look like in Velociraptor from Mongolia, not just Deinonychus? And then we also need to take a look back at those original evidence. Why were those Deinonychus, those raptors found in the same bone bed? Why were they found together? You know, that's something that needs to be answered.
And I've seen one suggestion, I think it might have been from you and your group. I read a bunch about this leading up to this, was an idea that, okay, maybe they're not hunting as a pack, but if they all happen to be in the same area and some prey shows up, they might all go after the same thing at the same time, even if they're not coordinating that.
Absolutely. When we're talking about pack hunting, we're talking about a spectrum of behaviors. And even the most basic aspect of pack hunting, the most basic social behavior, we do see that in crocodiles. Crocodiles will occasionally hold on to prey items while another one will come over and break a piece off, and they'll help each other out. Birds do this all the time. You may see a bird out in the street attacking a field mouse, like a crow, and maybe a few of them will take part in it taking individual turns attacking the same animal. That's called mobbing, and it's not uncommon. So it's quite possible that Deinonychus did work together. It just wasn't to the same degree as what we would see in a killer whale or a wolf, where individuals have their own roles, and they kind of have to stay in those roles regardless of what the prey animal is doing. That might just be a little bit too smart for the raptors.
You just mentioned two mammals, killer whales and wolves. Mm-hmm. Do we have any sign, apart from what we used to think about the ones we're talking about, that we see lizards participating in this sort of complex pack hunting approach?
Not to the same degree. I mean, don't get me wrong. Lizards and crocodiles and even birds will do have social behavior. They have social structure, and they will hunt together at times. They just don't have that role structure where one animal does something, another animal does another thing, regardless of what the prey is going to do.
And you mentioned at one point our feared velociraptors might look more like turkeys. And that reminds me, it seems like the consensus is growing pretty heavily that most dinosaurs that we think of may have had or probably had feathers. So where are we on that?
Absolutely. The raptors, which the technical term is the dromaeosaurs, are the lineage in which modern birds come from. And we do have evidence that Velociraptor specifically did have feathers. If you look at their arms of the bones, you'll actually see little holes where the quills from the flight feathers actually insert. So it's almost certain that these raptors, because of their close association with birds and their anatomy, had feathers to some degree. Now, how far does that track in the history of dinosaurs? We're not sure yet, but we're going to definitely find out with more collection.
Joseph, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
That's Joseph Fredrickson, vertebrate paleontologist and director of the Wise Earth Science Museum at the Fox Cities campus of the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. He recently led a study suggesting that velociraptors likely did not hunt in packs. Coming up, we'll talk to a historian about the Civil War roots of the Memorial Day holiday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the history of Memorial Day with historian Kenneth C. Davis. Right now, every year, millions of people 65 and older fall. And while most falls don't cause injuries, one out of five can lead to serious complications. Meanwhile, Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of death from unintentional falls in the nation, twice the national average. As you think about what you or your loved ones can do to prevent a fall, you might want to think about turning to the yoga mat. Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who has studied how yoga practice can improve balance and reduce falls for seniors. Dr. Hamrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this research on yoga and falls, can you talk about the importance of dealing with this issue of falls itself? Why is this so important?
Yeah, one-third of older adults over 65 fall each year, and that number increases to 50% at age 80 and older. So it's very, very common. But patients who sustain a hip fracture from a fall have a 50% chance of dying the following year because it's just so devastating, and a large number of them will not recover enough to live independently by themselves.
And why did you decide to research yoga in particular, and a particular kind of yoga, Hatha or Hatha yoga?
Yeah, so the yoga we chose is also called chair yoga. So it does not require the participant to get onto the floor. And the poses all can be done in a standing position while holding on to a chair or another surface like the wall. So it was much more acceptable. However, in future studies, we might want to include the floor because one of the reviewers, when we submitted it for publication, stated that as patients fall, they really need to learn how to get up from the floor. So having floor yoga included might also give them the tools to get up from a fall, should that happen.
And how much of this yoga did study participants do?
They participated in the class twice a week for 8 weeks, and it was an hour-long class. And then we split the group. There were 38 participants, and we split half of them to do home exercises of yoga and the other one, including meditation and breathing exercises. And the other half did only the meditation and breathing exercises, not the yoga poses at home, because we wanted to see if there was a difference between before and after, but also between the groups to see if those who practiced at home would have better outcomes.
We're talking to Dr. Irene Hamrick from UW-Madison, looking at the idea of using yoga to help prevent falls among people 65 and older. So, Dr. Hamrick, they did these yoga poses. They had a little bit of variation in what they did. What did you find? What were the results in terms of balance and fall prevention?
So we showed improvement in all balance and strength parameters that we measured, such as the Berg balance test and a number of other measures. But in addition to these intermediary measures, we also found falls reduction.
How much? How much of a difference did this seem to make?
So we had initially, we asked patients how much they had fallen before the study started. So in the 6 months before the study, 15 participants reported 27 falls. After the intervention, and we started counting at the onset of the classes because our study was rather short in funding. So we started when classes started and then counted 6 months, and 13 participants had 14 falls over those 6 months. So an almost 50% reduction.
So what is it about yoga that that would be helping people have better balance and avoid falls? Is it the physical activity? Is it being more conscious of what you're doing? Do we know why this would work?
That's an excellent question, and we don't really know. It was particularly interesting that the home exercise group did not improve any more than the group that did not practice at home. So just showing up for the class might be enough to stimulate the brain-muscle connection to improve balance and reduce falls. But we had a small study, so this really needs to be replicated in a larger study. But when we asked participants what they thought made the difference, they said, I'm much more aware of the 4 points of my foot on the floor. So it might have also been more the awareness, but we also don't know how much meditation or breathing exercises might have contributed to the improvement in falls. That is all something that needs to be studied further.
This study involved yoga and balance and falls prevention. You've looked at other interventions, too. What kind of things have you studied?
I have, with Dr. Jane Mahoney from the University of Wisconsin, rolled out the program of lifestyle intervention for functional exercise. This was a study done by Dr. Clemson out of Australia that integrated exercises into daily activities. Most of us who participate in classes for falls reduction will oftentimes do the exercises while we're doing the class, but after the class stops, we tend to not continue the exercises at home, and then the effect wanes over time. So Dr. Clemson's premise was if we integrate exercise into daily activities, we're more likely to continue them afterwards. Plus, people are more likely to do them if it doesn't take any extra additional time. So, for example, while brushing our teeth, we balance on one leg, or while we're wiping the table, we partially squat to build our quadricep muscles for balance. And, for example, while I do emails, I spend a lot of time in front of the computer, I partially squat and lean to all four directions to reach the limit of my sway to increase my balance muscles.
That's fascinating, because I think a lot of people, I'll include myself here, we think if I'm going to do some form of exercise, it means I have to set aside time for it. There might be equipment. I might have to go to a gym. And that means in many cases, I just don't do it. So it sounds like this plan would help people integrate it into their daily lives.
Exactly. So we're hoping to increase the repertoire that we can offer to patients if they are at risk of falls to prevent future falls, because some patients might want to do yoga, others might not, and they might need to integrate their exercise into the daily activities because they have a very busy schedule.
How much of this is a mindset issue? As I get older, I imagine I'll be less interested in doing physical activity. It might not be on my radar. How important is it just to get people thinking, hey, if I do this physical activity, even at a limited level, it's going to make me safer and healthier?
That is an important piece. We really have to change the mindset of all of us, because more and more data is coming out of the benefits of exercise for everything from cancer to preventing dementia and, of course, falls.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Hamrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She shared how practicing yoga, even integrating it into our daily lives, can help prevent falls among older Wisconsinites. Coming up, we'll talk to a historian about the Civil War roots of the Memorial Day holiday. We'll find out how it's changed over the decades and how it's been a point of controversy all along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network on this Memorial Day holiday. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, with almost 100,000 people dead in the U.S. in the coronavirus pandemic, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at mourning and grief and how they've changed in the last few months. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for more than 150 years, Americans have observed Memorial Day, though it's been known under different names along the way. While the name has changed and new wars and conflicts have come along, the intent remains the same: to honor and remember those who have died in service to their country. And Memorial Day has its roots in one of the bloodiest conflicts in our history, the Civil War. Our next guest joins us to talk about the history of the holiday. Kenneth C. Davis is an author and historian. He's the author of the Don't Know Much About History series, and his latest book is More Deadly Than War: The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Great to be back with you. Thank you for having me on this very, very special day in American history.
And Ken, I know before we dig into the history, I know you want to make a point to the public about, you know, remembering that it's not just any old three-day weekend. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. Look, most of us think about us, except this year. Obviously, we're in an extraordinary moment in American history. For the most part, when most people think Memorial Day, they're thinking beach, swimsuit sales, or mattress sales, even worse. Look, it's the first weekend of the summer. I get that for most of us. It's a wonderful time. But it really is the most solemn day on the American national calendar. It is a day to honor not just veterans, not just those who served, but specifically those who gave the last full measure of devotion, as Lincoln put it so memorably in the Gettysburg Address. So it is a special holiday that we should understand. It was very divisive and partisan in its roots, and it's changed a lot over 150 odd years, but we must really understand what it's about today.
Well, let's dig back now into the early history. What are some of the earliest examples of people observing Memorial Day, something like Memorial Day, around this time of year?
Well, there were, look, the idea of going out and and making a funeral oration to the dead soldier goes back to the time of Pericles in ancient Athens, one of the most famous speeches in Western civilization. And Lincoln certainly gave that speech in 1863 in Gettysburg, November 1863. During the Civil War, there are instances of people marking the graves of fallen soldiers while the war was still going on. But what we think of as the official beginning of Memorial or Decoration Day, as it was known when I was a kid, was May 30th, 1868. A very prominent American politician, Civil War general named General John Logan, was head of a fraternal organization called the Grand Army of the Republic. He declared that May 30th would be the day that people should go out and strew fresh flowers on the graves of the fallen soldiers. And he was referring specifically to the Union soldiers. This was seen as a Northern holiday. It was a holiday to celebrate the fact that these soldiers had died to save the Union and also to end slavery. That's why many of the Confederate states marked their own separate holiday. And so this became a day that was honored in late 19th century America because of the enormous losses. Of course, 600,000 at least American soldiers died in the Civil War. That number is probably a lot higher. By the way, in Wisconsin, the losses were quite extreme. Wisconsin sent more than 90,000 young men to fight in the South, and more than 12,000 of them never came back.
Yeah, let's detour to Wisconsin a little bit, and a lot of people know Camp Randall as the place to go see the UW Badgers football team play. The history of Camp Randall, though, a lot of it, some of its most prominent history goes back to the Civil War era. Can you talk about that?
That's right. It was begun as a camp which was meant for training those young men who were going off to war. Obviously, America did not have much of a standing army in 1861 when the war began. Lincoln begins the call for volunteers, and they start to pour in. Camp Randall in Wisconsin was begun as a training camp for the Union Army during the Civil War, and more than 70,000 recruits were trained there. Most interestingly, or in addition to that interest, and especially at this time, there were two things that set Camp Randall apart. First of all, it was there that the former governor's widow, Miss Cordelia Harvey, persuaded President Lincoln to establish hospitals. Very appropriate to be thinking about what healthcare workers do in the time of war and in a time of crisis at this moment. So Cordelia Harvey really gets a page in history on her own. But it was also a prisoner of war camp for Confederate prisoners, and more than 1,000 Confederate soldiers were being held there at one point, and some died, and they were buried at Camp Randall in what is known as the Confederate Rest.
And there was a controversy across the country on both sides about how the other side was treating prisoners of war. And ultimately, I gather the conditions at Camp Randall, even by the Union standards for Confederate captives, wasn't up to par. They ended up moving them to Illinois, I believe.
That's correct. We think of the Civil War, if you have a little bit of knowledge about it, you might have heard of Andersonville, the very notorious camp for Union soldiers in Georgia, which, by the way, after the war, Clara Barton was sent to Andersonville to try and find the missing in action and the missing soldiers there. Rather extra, we think of Clara Barton. Again, this connection of women and nursing in wartime is a very powerful one in the Civil War. Clara Barton begins this mission to find the lost soldiers of Andersonville. But there were Union prisoner of war camps spread across the North. And indeed, they did have standards for how to keep these prisoners. The situation at Camp Randall was a lot of not so much mistreatment or starvation or anything like that, which was the case in Andersonville, but a lot of disease. measles, mumps. These were the killers of the Civil War in large number. In fact, when we talk about the war dead from Wisconsin, that 12,000 number, probably 9,000 of them were people who died, men who died from disease rather than actual battle wounds.
We're talking to historian Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series, talking about the history today of Memorial Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the history of Memorial Day or Decoration Day, or if you want to tell us how you are observing Memorial Day maybe differently this year than you might have in the past. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ken, let's get back into the early controversy. And this is a controversy in some ways that's lasted to this day. How do we remember the Confederacy? How do we remember soldiers who died on that side and in that cause? Can you talk about some of the early controversy over whether this holiday was meant to be Union side only?
It was clearly Union side only. And if you go back to General Logan's original, it was called an order, even though he was not a general at the time. He was actually in Congress at the time. But the head of this very, very powerful Union organization called the Grand Army of the Republic. And he issued this call for May 30th, 1868, and he said, "We should guard their graves with sacred vigilance. This should be a fitting tribute to the memory of the slain defenders. It's a day to honor those who died in the cause of ending slavery and opposing the rebellion." So it was clearly a partisan Union holiday, and that is why the former Confederate states began their own Confederate Memorial Days or Decoration Days. There's even records of the very first ceremony at Arlington, and for quite a while afterwards, they actually posted guards at Arlington to keep any Confederate families out on this day, because there are Confederate soldiers buried in Arlington, which, by the way, is also a vestige of the Civil War. It is built on land that was confiscated from the family of Robert E. Lee during the war, on the pretense of sorts of not paying taxes, but it was clearly retribution for Lee's leaving the Union, leaving the United States Army, and going to fight with Virginia and lead armies against the United States Army.
Now, I've wondered about the timing, why late May for Memorial Day, and if I have it right, it's because it's a good time to have lots of flowers?
That's it. It was selected apparently because it's the date on which the most flowers are in bloom in the North. Again, a hint that this is a northern holiday. And that was the idea, not just to think about these men, but to actually go to the graveyards and put fresh flowers on the graves. And that is why it was called Decoration Day, to decorate the graves. As time changed, Rob, you know, the Civil War generation got older. Most of them died off, certainly by the turn of the 20th century. This had already become something of a holiday picnic weekend. It was already the weekend where you didn't go to the cemetery anymore necessarily, or you went for a little while, but then you went and had a picnic. But something changed, of course, in 1918, and that is, of course, the United States involvement in World War I. And it's really the losses in World War I, 102 years ago, ended November 11th, 1918, that revives the idea of Decoration Day or Memorial Day, not just as a Civil War holiday now, but a day to honor all those who died in service to the country, which is how we see it today, of course. And it was at that time that they decided to establish the Tomb of the Unknown at Arlington, which was dedicated in 1921. And the first soldier in that tomb, of course, was from World War I, later to be added a World War II serviceman, and then a Korean War serviceman. A Vietnam-era serviceman was interred for some time. His body was later identified and later reinterred, I believe, near St. Louis.
We're talking to author and historian Ken Davis right now about the history of Memorial Day and its roots in the Civil War. We'll pick up at World War I coming up. Ken's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in that series. His latest book, by the way, we've talked about it on the show, More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of Memorial Day, its origins, when it changed from Decoration Day to Memorial Day? If you have memories of the holiday you'd like to share, or if you'd like to tell us how you are observing Memorial Day in this different year where public gatherings aren't so likely, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about the history of Memorial Day and its roots in the Civil War. Our guest is author and historian Kenneth C. Davis. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, your observations on Memorial Day and how we mark it, or maybe don't mark it enough, as Ken says. He hopes you'll take some time to think about the meaning of the holiday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ken, let's talk about now how Memorial Day changed. You were starting to talk about this in World War One. Now, this, as opposed to the Civil War, this is something that kind of brought the nation together in many ways. Not everybody, of course, approved of World War One, but we, as a country, we're all on the same side here. How did that change the way we approached Decoration Day or Memorial Day?
Well, it did take it from this somewhat divisive partisan sense of a holiday and into a truly national holiday, because now the United States, of course, there had been other military engagements in between the Civil War and World War One, the most significantly the Spanish-American War, which was fairly short-lived and not a tremendous loss of lives. But with World War One, you have the loss of nearly, more than 100,000 American soldiers die in World War One, but that was in a very short period of time. The troops land in May of 1918. About a million American soldiers land in May of 1918. The war is over in November of 1918. About 100,000 men die in that period. And of course, some of them died, many of them died from the Spanish flu, because the two things were completely connected. So there was a new sense of seeing this holiday as an opportunity, a possibility to remember all of America's losses in all of its wars. And that's when, as I said, it was determined that they should build the monument to the unknown soldier, a tradition that had existed in Europe long before then.
And the poppy flower is often associated with dead service members, the people who died in the line of duty. And this is around the time that happens during World War One.
That's right. It's also another World War One tradition that comes out of a poem that was written in 1915. Remember, the war starts in August 1914. The United States is not involved in it. A poem is written in 1915 by a young Canadian surgeon. His name just escaped me, but the poem is called In Flanders Fields. And it begins, "In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row by row." It became internationally famous in the English-speaking world, of course. And a young American woman saw the poppy, the symbol of loss, of sacrifice, of death, of remembrance. She started to sell poppies to raise money for soldiers, widows, and orphans. And that was the beginning of what was called the poppy movement. It is as big and maybe bigger in Great Britain. Perhaps you saw at the 100th anniversary of the end of the war in 2018, there were poppies covering, you know, buildings in London and in France as well. So this is a very powerful symbol. I remember being a kid around this time of year, being in school. The veterans would come into our classroom and sell those little paper poppies to us. And, you know, you wanted to plunk down your quarter and buy a poppy from those veterans. It was a very, very meaningful thing. I don't know what the poppy movement is like this year. We can't really be out selling things on the street hand to hand, but it's still a powerful symbol of what war and loss really mean.
Oh, and our producer's passed along the name John McCrae, the author of
John
In Flanders
McCrae.
Field.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, JC, for passing that along. And now talk about how we've institutionalized, Ken, Memorial Day since then. As you said, you grew up celebrating it as Decoration Day still.
That's right. You know, when I was a kid, it was a really important holiday for us in my small town, as it is in many small towns, partly because Memorial Day fell during the school year. So it was a school day off, but we didn't actually have a day off. It was the day that all the schools would march and participate in the town's parade. It was really much more important, much more significant in many ways than the 4th of July, which happened in the summertime when school was out. So this was, to me, and my father was a World War II veteran. Most of my uncles and other relatives had served in World War II. So this was a very powerful holiday for me growing up. The big change institutionally was that it became a national holiday in the 1960s. Before then, it was really up to governors to proclaim Memorial Day. In 1968, it becomes a national holiday. It's ultimately moved from the traditional May 30th date to the third Monday in May, and that is where it is today. The other big difference that I have to point out here is that the Vietnam War changed a lot of people's attitudes towards Memorial Day. During the 60s, Memorial Day, because the war was so unpopular, we had a different approach to thinking about it at the time. We couldn't disconnect the service of the soldiers from the unpopularity of the war. So Memorial Day fell into not disrepair or disrepute. It just didn't have the same resonance for a period during Vietnam than it did later. And it took a long time to get past that. I think it's only with the opening of the extraordinary Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., designed by Maya Lin, that we get some closure on that period. And those young men and women who went off to Vietnam and were not welcomed for their service when they came back finally felt that they were getting their appropriate recognition for what they had done.
I want to take our last minute, Ken, to ask you. You've mentioned the Spanish flu. You had a so-called Spanish flu. You had a book about the history there and how it intersected with the First World War. Just take a minute. Any lessons or thoughts you have looking back just over a century at that epidemic to today?
Very powerful lessons and very perfect example of why history matters. The first lesson is the most important, perhaps. Spanish flu started in the spring. It came back worse in September. We have to keep that in mind right now. We cannot think that this thing is over in the next few months. The second thing is that it was really driven by propaganda, lies, and censorship early on in 1918. That's a very dangerous combination. We've seen that today as well. And two more quick points related. We can't ignore science. It's lethal to ignore science. They did in 1918. In Philadelphia, the warnings were don't have a parade to sell Liberty loans. They went ahead and did it. 200,000 people in the street. 2 days later, every hospital bed in Philadelphia was filled. And finally, the last point is misplaced priorities. Many cities like Philadelphia thought the war effort was more important than the public health. And that was one of the reasons that the Spanish flu was so deadly.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Kenneth C. Davis, author and historian. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and a number of other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book, we were just touching on a little of it there, it was called More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. He joined us today to talk about the Civil War roots of the Memorial Day holiday. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll take a look at how Wisconsin prisons are dealing with COVID-19 and learn about the risks that are facing inmates and staff. One of our WPR news team has been covering that issue. She'll give us the latest. We'll hear the stories of how people of different ages are finding joy in a difficult and uncertain time, and we hope you'll call in and share your stories too. And we know, all know it can be tough to talk about controversial issues, especially in polarized times where it's easy to focus on what we disagree about more than what we agree about. We'll hear from an author who shares advice on having compassionate conversations, even on issues that it looks like we have such fundamental disagreements that we can't look past them. All that and a look at some of the top news of the day is coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.